I was not actually intending to write a mystery, and it's actually not my first novel. I have one sitting around unpublished, like a lot of writers do. That was more of a literary novel set in Afghanistan. My agent tried very hard to sell it, could not, and then said, write another book, which was not the most welcome news. So I started rooting through my stuff and found a fragment that survives almost intact as the prologue to this novel. And the way it's set up, there's nothing it could be but a mystery novel. I think I shied away from it for a while because I'm not that familiar with the form.
Do you have the plot outlined in your head before you write the first paragraph?
Very vaguely. I have the beginning in my head, obviously, and I have the end in my head. That's a pretty firm thing. I write toward that ending. I have a really vague idea about the middle. If I were to write out all of those things and really work at it, I could maybe come up with 5 pages, and then I only need another 345.
This is not your simple whodunit. What attracted me to the book, Gwen, is how vivid the writing is. And I don't read mysteries generally. It's not my genre, but I always think of them as being pretty straightforward and heavy on dialogue. But your novel has just really descriptive writing, and I love that.
Oh, thank you so much. And I think Montana just sort of demands that. It's hard to, you know, one of the appeals of the state is its visual appeal. And I really wanted to capture that.
Yeah. But you get past, you know, the snow-capped peaks kind of thing. And to show our listeners what I'm talking about, I marked a passage that I would love to have you read that I think sort of exemplifies what we were just talking about, if you don't mind.
Sure. The city was in the rental car's rearview mirror, and then it wasn't, vanishing without the softening aspect of suburbs. Ahead, bare foothills bunched like fist, knuckled ridges pressing back against the weight of sky. The road arced around the hills in lazy swooping curves, then without warning, hairpin through cliffs that leaned in above her, slicing the sky to manageable size. There's that reference to the big sky.
Right. That's a reporter's eye, Gwen, don't you think?
I think so, and I think when I wrote this book and also the sequel to it, which is called Dakota and it's set in the Bakken, I made trips to both of these locations and did what I would do on any reporting trip. I just kind of jotted down notes on what things looked like, how they felt, what they smelled like. All of those things that I used to use in my reporting came in really handy with novels, actually, and talking to people. That's a huge thing for a novel, just to sort of get a sense of the place and how people sound.
You mentioned that you have written a sequel, and mm-hmm. will Lola be the lead character in that, too? She's the lead character in Montana.
Lola will be back, and as cantankerous as ever.
And we should say that Lola is a journalist who's been pulled off her overseas gig in Afghanistan because of budget cuts at a paper, a big city paper, and she ends up in Montana, where, unfortunately, she comes upon her dead friend, and that is what kicks the novel off.
Right. And I made Lola a journalist for a couple of reasons. Obviously, it's write what you know. And there is a part of me that wants to correct a lot of the images of journalists you see in movies. For one thing, they always have offices, sometimes even secretaries, which baffles me. And they're well-dressed. No journalist is well-dressed, even if they could afford it. I don't think they've got the DNA to do that. The other thing I wanted to kind of play with in this book is what's been happening in journalism over the last few years. Newsrooms have just been decimated, and I think that's a terrible thing. So I got to work out a little bit of stuff in this book.
And speaking of that, Gwen, and just to go off the book subject for a little bit, you have left journalism. Was that a factor in that?
Actually, the bigger factor was wanting to write fiction full time, which I think everyone who writes fiction wants to do. Few people have the luxury of being able to do it. I'm lucky to have a very supportive partner that enabled me to do it. Also, the fact that at that point I had a 2-book contract, so I felt fairly secure. But yeah, I've been unhappy, as I would say probably every journalist in the country is, with what's been happening. So,
in terms of cutbacks?
In terms of cutbacks and making it much harder to do what I think is a very important job. So it's a little bit of a bittersweet thing. I love the work, and I miss it, but I really love what I'm doing now.
Yeah. It's having to do more with less is what journalism
exactly,
is now.
And less and less and less.
Right. Back to the book. The lead character, Lola, ends up in Montana, as we said, to visit her friend who's then murdered. But then she ends up falling in love with Montana in a way.
She does.
And she's like a lot of people who move here who are kind of loners and then find some solace.
And that's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought of it that way. I had fun making her a reluctant convert to Montana. I was one of those people who walked off a plane, looked around, and said, I have got to live here. Lola's not that person. She, when she first got here, could not wait to get out and picked apart everything she found about it. But as you pointed out, she eventually, you know, got under her skin the way it does with a lot of people.
This is not a tourism promotion book for Montana, though. You do look at a lot of what are harsh realities in Montana. You especially look at how hard life on the reservation is here and the addiction and drug problems that many Native American communities face.
Right, and I wanted to strike a it's kind of a tightrope to walk there. You don't want to walk away from those realities. You can't ignore them. I think it's really tough that people have to deal with those. Nor do I want to sentimentalize Indians, which I think a lot of people do. So I tried to basically portray a community working very hard to deal with those issues, and Lola kind of plopped down in the middle of it, not understanding any of it, and trying to work her way through all the nuances.
There's a especially vivid scene of a mother of a young Indian boy who has a teenage boy who has died from a drug overdose. And there's a scene where she's being told of his death. I love that scene, and I wonder if I could prevail upon you to read that again.
Sure. This is when Lola is riding in a car with the sheriff, and he gets a call that there's an emergency, basically. There's no more details than that. Lola isn't sure what's going on, only that suddenly they're going 100 miles an hour with the sirens going. They end up at a trailer park, and a bunch of kids come running out of the trailer. Not all of the kids leave the trailer. And Lola is told to stay outside next to this young boy's mother while the sheriff is inside investigating. And the mother is talking and talking to her, babbling that final forestalling. Keep talking and people will be polite, Lola thought. They won't talk over you, won't tell you what you can't bear to hear. A thing isn't true until it's said. Charlie, that's the sheriff, talked over her anyway. Ma'am, you're going to have to come on down to the office with me. The woman shook her head. No. You can ride with me. I'll send someone to get your car. The woman's hands covered her ears. A thing isn't true until it's said, until you hear it. No, she said again, and Lola caught her as she started to go down, limbs jackknifing, lips parting to draw breath for the mighty rising scream, and Lola wished, as she wrapped the woman tight in her arms, that someone had been there to catch her when she'd found Mary Alice. Mary Alice, of course, is Lola's friend who was murdered at the beginning of the book.
The thing isn't true until it's said. I love that.
Yeah, and I think that's how people react when they know bad news is coming. I always think of, you know, the people waiting outside the operating room and the doctor comes walking down the hall and you know from the look on his face, but you just start talking, saying, I'm not going to hear this.
I read on your blog that you said, quote, that fiction is easier to write than journalism. And then you said, journalism is easier to write than fiction.
I think both are true. There's the wonderful thing in fiction where you do have control. There are no bad quotes. You know, you're not trying to persuade somebody to talk. You can make them say whatever you want them to say. The downside of that is you have to make up the good quotes. And I remember that when I first started writing fiction, and this still plagues me, you sit down and look at that blank screen and you think, where are my notes? As a journalist, you interview people, you've got these notes, you've done some research, and all your material is right there, and all you have to do is assemble it. You know, now I have to write my own notes.
Tough to write that lead, right?
Yeah. And it's actually very similar. I've started thinking of novels as just very long newspaper stories. There needs to be a really interesting lead, which is the beginning to a newspaper story. There had better be a good kicker, which is the end. And then there's all that stuff in the middle.
Well, all that stuff in the middle is very fun to read. And I have been speaking with Gwen Florio, who's the author of the new mystery novel called Montana and has a second novel coming out soon, I presume.
In March.
And that will be called
Dakota. Yeah.
And set in the Bakken.
That was much fun.
Well, Gwen, best of luck with both novels and your new career. It's really fun to talk to you about it.
Thanks so much.